The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Elizabeth Wellington, and I am the longtime lifestyle and fashion columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I'm incredibly excited about introducing our guest here tonight. Imani Perry is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies, as well as a faculty associate in the program in Law and Public Affairs and Gender and Sexuality at the University. She is the author of 6 books, most recently, the award-winning Breathe, A Letter to My Sons, and Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. Imani will interview the incomparable Tarana Burke. I first met Tarana Burke several years ago when I was first starting my job at the Philadelphia Inquirer at the Art Sanctuary. Back then, hashtags were not a thing. But Tarana was then using the words, 2 important words, me too, to affirm the experience of other young Black girls who sadly had been victims of sexual harassment and assault. Today, she is the face of a global movement, and she is the recipient of several awards, including the prestigious Radner Prize for Courage, the VH1 Trailblazer Award, and she's been Time Magazine's Person of the Year, as well as one of its most influential people of the year. Earlier this year, Tarana released You Are the Best Thing, Vulnerability, Shame, and Resilience, with another favorite of mine, Brené Brown. Shortly after that book was released, it became a New York Times bestseller. And tonight, we are here to celebrate her new memoir, Unbound, released just this past Tuesday. So please, everybody, put your hands together for these 2 amazing women, Imani Perry and Tarana Burke.
Thank you. It's weird. Yeah.
Oh, Tarana!
Hey!
Hey!
I'm
all right. I am just, well, let me start by saying this is congratulations. This has been an amazing week. Like, it's a series of congratulations for this incredible book, and that it has been so appreciated and received with so much appropriate love and appreciation. And so I'm just thrilled to be able to talk to you. I'm gonna like navigate between the fact that I absolutely love you as a person and I absolutely love this book and I'm being professional, but I'm just open to it. And I'm like, every day I'm like, mommy, you know, Toronto's on TV, turn on your TV. Okay, so I want to ask if it's okay if you'll read a section of the book.
Yes.
And I want you to, I'll tell you which pages, but I, because I have some questions. One of my favorite sections, although the whole book is just gorgeous, but I wanted to ask if you would read, this is kind of a lot, but I think it would be wonderful for, especially for folks who haven't read the book yet, from the top of page 68 to the, like, that sentence that ends on the top of 73.
I'm gonna say something that's gonna sound crazy.
Yes.
I have the other book here. So let me make sure.
The page number. Oh, the where it starts, my favorite class was honors.
Okay. So the top of page 68 to
like that, just finishing that sentence at the bottom of 72.
Oh, okay. Well, here we go. My favorite class was honors English. My mother was the reason that I fell in love with literature. Our home was a Black woman's literary paradise. She had hundreds of books all over our house, and a majority of them were by the most beloved and revered Black women writers of our lifetime. Toni Morrison and Alice Walker, Gwendolyn Brooks and Ntozake Shange, Nikki Giovanni and Maya Angelou, and among others. I was drawn in by the pretty covers and spectacular titles. Maya Angelou's books in particular were dazzling and inviting, but every time I asked my mom if I could read one, she would say I wasn't ready. I obeyed her and left the books alone, but my curiosity only grew. One day, while my mom was out of the house, I couldn't help myself. I snuck her copy of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings off the shelf. I had to have been around 12. I had assumed my mother held me back from reading the book because she thought it would be too difficult to understand, but the words came easy. It didn't take long before I was hooked. Reading the opening chapter about young Maya running out of the church peeing on herself reminded me of a similarly embarrassing moment in my own life. There was something so strangely comforting about reading how she laughed at her embarrassment, even though she knew the adults would punish her and the other kids would tease her. I found myself wishing that I was her friend so that I could learn to laugh at myself too, even when I was scared. I kept reading, fascinated by the way she talked about her thoughts and emotions and how many of them mirrored how I felt about myself. And then Mr. Freeman was introduced. I understand now why my mother might have been wary of my reading this book too soon. Maya Angelou wrote about being molested and raped by her mother's boyfriend when she was 8 years old. My mom, who had no idea that my life was being mirrored in this book, likely didn't want me to read it in an attempt to protect me from an ugly reality I had unfortunately already experienced. Instead of being horrified and compelled to ask incessant questions, I was being introduced to a truth that would forever alter my life. My 12-year-old mind had not understood that this was a thing, that this was a thing that happened to other girls who were innocent. I thought it was just me, or at least girls like me. I thought I was the kind of girl who bad things happened to. When I read about what happened to a young Maya Angelou, I was able to read her as innocent in a way I didn't allow of myself. Maya was decent and nice, and it seemed egregious that God would have allowed something so horrible to happen to her. It was the first time I ever realized a little girl like her could have gone through what I went through. I finished the book and kept what was now, in my mind, our secret. To my 12-year-old self, Maya Angelou was just another name on my mother's bookshelf. She wasn't Dr. Maya Angelou, the esteemed poet, author, activist, and all-around legend. She was a lady who wrote a book that shared my secrets. She was my confidant. I no longer felt alone. By the time I was in high school, my love for Maya Angelou and her work had only grown. So I was excited when we were assigned to read and interpret her landmark poem, Phenomenal Woman, in my honors English class. My teacher, Mr. Pete, was a roundish, middle-aged white man with a dirty blonde comb over and an unkempt, bushy mustache. He was more partial to tweed car coats and brogans than to khakis and polo shirts, his fellow male teachers wore. I remember him always smelling of old deli meat, but he prided himself on thinking outside of the box and didn't seem jaded by the daily barrage of brown faces like many of his contemporaries. He prided himself on coming up with new and inventive ways for us to learn, and when he thought he was connecting with us, a sly smirk would creep across his face, and he'd start to walk with a little bop in his step, basking in his white liberal glory. The day he introduced Phenomenal Woman to the class was one of his glory days. He passed out the handout saying, "You guys are so going to love this." He seemed very proud of himself for having the poem in his Black History Month curriculum. Most of the class didn't know the poem, and many didn't know who Mama Maya was, but a jolt of excitement went through my body when I saw her name on the paper. My hand shot up to volunteer when Mr. Pete asked for someone to read the poem aloud. A classmate and I took turns. My body was buzzing the whole time. My worlds were colliding. I even caught myself wishing my mom was there to watch me. I was in full performance mode. I took my time with each phrase, acting out and over-enunciating. I wanted my classmates to laugh, but more than anything, I was proud to be speaking her words. When we were finished, Mr. Pete thanked us for reading and turned to the rest of the class. What do you think this poem is about? Someone quickly raised their hand, barely waiting to be called on. They said, it's about her letting the world know that she was fly. The class laughed, and Mr. Pete nodded vigorously, using the student's comment to launch into his own interpretation. It was her way of saying, hey world, look at me. I'm a black woman, and I'm just as good as any white woman. His comment irritated me a little bit, but I couldn't quite pinpoint why. He quieted the class and put on a videotape of Dr. Maya Angelou reciting the poem. Then it hit me. The entire class sat intently listening to the performance, but I was holding my breath. In all the time I had spent being enamored by her life, her strength, and her words, I had never actually heard her voice. Her regal tone and accent and protracted enunciation were unlike anything I had ever heard from a black woman. It was completely unfamiliar to me, and I was mesmerized. She stood at a podium wearing a black and silver dress with the broadest, warmest smile on her face. She made little jokes that sent flickers of laughter across the audience. She rolled her tongue and lowered her tone and pronounced every single word as if each one was her very own invention. She was absolutely divine. My mother's all-time favorite artist is Patti LaBelle. I always thought of her presence as big, grand, and divine because of her big hair and sparkling clothes and that booming voice that commanded your attention. Here was Dr. Angelou standing at a podium, and though beautifully dressed, she was using nothing but words to command such a presence. Now, should I keep going?
Please, this class, next page. I'm sorry, I know it's a long piece, but I just want people to hear this next page, but that's okay.
When the performance was done, Mr. Pete stopped the recording and went into this weird diddy bop movement he'd like to do. She's talking jive, right? She's kind of trash talking and saying, yeah, I'm better than you and you better believe it. He said all this with his smug, smirk, mocking jive talk in this ridiculous way only a white person would. My breath came back to me all at once. What are you talking about? No. Mr. Pete turned to me calmly. He was used to my outbursts and gestured for me to continue. Okay, Tarana, elaborate. He always pronounced my name wrong. No matter how often I corrected him, he said Ran in the middle instead of Ron. It worked my nerves. I might not have known the term microaggressions then, but I was old enough to peep that he was doing that shit on purpose. I leaned forward in my seat, my words slow and deliberate, trying to walk back my attitude. Maya Angelou was talking about appreciating who she was as a black woman because nobody else would. She wasn't jive talking or comparing herself to a white woman. All black women should feel the way she felt in the poem because we are all queens. It was the 90s. It was the 80s.
That's right, yes.
She never once mentioned white women or being white at all. Excuse me. I was passionate about my response. It was just like a white man to open his mouth and believe she had to be talking about them, and I wasn't having it. I kept going. This poem is powerful because she is powerful. And we're not even talking about all the stuff she's been through, I explained. This is a poem about a black woman making sure the world understands that she is not defeated despite what they might think of her.
There's a bunch of reasons I love this passage. And one is the way that you talk about the landscape of your home, like a black woman's literary paradise. And it's so important because, one, I think we don't get that often, this a window into how important literature is for Black girls and women. And especially in the 80s and even the 90s, when our faces weren't very many places. Like, our stories were in books, not visible. And also the books could share, I mean, when that encounter you had on the page with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and I'll say, you know, and I'm not the only one to say this, this Unbound feels to me like this generation's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And really, in a whole bunch of ways, which I want to talk about more, but it feels like, you know, there's a space that can happen where you can connect through literature, sometimes things that are hard to say.
Yeah. I found so many. I mean, you know, there was I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, but there was also The Bluest Eye.
Yes. Right?
It was also for colored girls. I mean, there were so many books that introduced me into womanhood, or introduced me into the world, introduced me. And I found myself in all these little bits and pieces. And you're right. There was no television. I mean, we had like Dominique Devereaux, you know,
it was like, yeah, right, those two.
or like Angie, you know, it was like these little bits and pieces. People don't know who we're talking about, right?
Right at all. They really don't.
You know, there was like always this excitement when you saw a Black girl on television, but the books allowed us to get into the material lives of Black girls and Black women. Mm-hmm. And it's very different than seeing you on television when you can only get a little piece of who we were.
Yeah. And I also love this. I mean, your teacher, you like depict him perfectly. Like, we can see him. We know that guy. Right. But also, you know, there's like it's a foreshadowing of later life, because like you were saying something with, you know, Mama Maya's words, and somebody's not quite getting it, and you have to like do the correction, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, I mean, in a sense that is also part of the story of Me Too and why the book is so important, right? Because you had to correct the story of what it is.
That is absolutely that. I haven't made that connection, but that's a great connection to make. It is a foreshadowing. And I think it's actually also an example of just how that happens over and over and over in so many different ways in our lives. We have to say, that's not what I mean, or that's not what I said, or that's not, you know, Black women being misinterpreted, being misunderstood, just in so many different arenas.
Mm-hmm. And the importance of saying something, right? Yeah, because you know, there's a message. You should be happy to be in an honors class.
Exactly.
You should be happy to be the subject of attention. And then, what does it mean to say, well, but no, this is where the center of gravity.
Oh yeah, I'm so sure that he was so happy that, you know, he was bringing this Black woman's poem into our classroom, and that we should just be grateful that we're studying, you know, that he's introducing us to this Black work. Even the idea, and I wrote about that because it was such a big moment in my life, but also, you know, even expanding on that, I just remember this feeling of him almost being disappointed that I knew who Maya Angelou was, that he wasn't.
The person to bring it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I'm like, no, I got this at home, thanks. Yeah.
that is, you know, it was Black women readers supported Black women writers back, you know, we were the audience, or our mothers were the audience,
yeah. Right?
Which is important. Okay, so we met, gosh, like Issa was just a baby, so like 15 years ago, a little over 15 years ago.
Right.
Yes. Oh, right. So, and you were already doing this work,
mm-hmm.
which is something that, as many times as you've said it, the world doesn't always seem to understand. And one of the things that you, for me, is really beautiful about the book is you connect, you know, Me Too to the movement work that you were nurtured in, but also that you came from, again, at home, mm-hmm. and then through 21st century, like where your life is you come of age with movement, essentially.
Yeah.
I
am definitely shaped by, I mean, I come from a very conscious family, right? You know, my granddaddy was a race man for sure. And And so I was raised with that level of consciousness that you can tell, you know, at our age now, you can tell folks who are raised reading certain things, being exposed to certain things, right? And so I love that. I love being that's a part of my history, but it was really clear. The thing I think that is a disconnect in some of that upbringing for a lot of us, you're raised in those kind of families and your endeavor is to go to college and do really well, maybe go to HBCU, or, you know, you do really well and you contribute back to your community. And that is either financially or whatever way you move back home. I think there's this really particular path you can take. I had a yearning to do something about the injustice that this information had helped me identify, right? I'm like, well, yeah. Now you know what racism is, right? You taught me what oppression looks like. You're teaching me these, you know, about white supremacy. What do we do? Mm-hmm. And my mother and my grandfather didn't have those particular answers. They just wanted me to make sure I had the information. And then it was once I was introduced to current movement, people who were part of the legacy of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement and the labor movement and those kind of, you know, the movements of the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, you know, once I was introduced into that world, that's what shaped, it took the information that I had been given and nurtured within my family and helped to take that energy that I had building up in me and put that out into the world. And so my inclination was to organize. But I should also say that I didn't just learn organizing because of the consciousness of my family and the movement people. My stepfather was a number runner in the Bronx.
Yes.
And for people who don't, either it's an illegal gambling business that happens, that used to happen. I don't know if they probably still have numbers, but in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, it was a huge thing, very community, very local. But that person who was the number runner was also a community leader. And so my inclination for organizing also came from watching my mother and my stepfather organize the children in the summer to make sure they got out of the community, right? And went on bus rides and to picnics and things like that. To organize the tenant association, to organize the block party, to put together rent parties, right? I saw all of that kind of organizing. So I was also raised in a community that was very nurturing, and that our first instinct was to take care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen with my own eyes situations where the community made a decision to call on each other before they called the police.
Yes.
I watched that actually happen. So when we had community problems, we sought out community solutions. And I saw that in the civil rights movement and the folks who came from those movements. And I saw that in my community. So it was just natural to have that in me, you know, it was like a part of my DNA.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that too, because, and again, for me, it's a lesson that Maya taught us as well, right? Because she came from a very loving community,
mm-hmm.
nurturing community, an organized community, and still tragic things happen, right? That's the reality, right? And then, you know, became an organizer and a writer, right? Yeah. An organized person and a writer, right? And mm-hmm. I remember, like, you had a blog some years ago, yeah. And that you write these absolutely gorgeous pieces, like, just sort of not with a, like, intent to do a particular thing with them, but to share. And they were, you know, and I remember being like, you know, this woman is a writer, right? like a writer, like not a blogger. I mean, not to diss bloggers. I know they're wonderful, but you know, and so I, you know, one, I want to follow up with hearing from you a little bit more, just, and I know this already, but just for the audience, the work, you know, why was it so important to take the skills, the habits, the values that you learned from organizing and then bring it back and in some sense, turn it as a mirror onto our own community. Okay, now let's this is something that is worth our organizing, our compassion, our passion, our commitment, as much, you know, sexual violence, as much as, or more than anything else. It's the most, you know.
Yeah, I think there's two lessons that come in my mind when I think about that. And both of them are lessons from elders from our community. One of the early organizing lessons that I got is that what I just said, community problems have to have community solutions. They deserve community solutions. And that's how I was taught to look at things. If something is happening in our community, the community should rise up and respond to it. We should not be waiting for people to come from outside the community to resolve our problems, because those are not people who are invested in and care about it. It has to start with us. And then the second one is that we have to take what we have to make what we need. You know, that's always been, and you know, I have an elder who has built his legacy on that idea of taking what you have to make what you need. And the thing that was happening around me was an enormous community problem. It wasn't really like profound wisdom. You know, I'm not trying to diminish myself at all. It really was sort of like my training kicking in. I did not know what to do. I did not set out thinking I would be organizing around sexual violence. I did not set out thinking I would be doing any work around sexual violence. I wanted to do youth leadership development for Black girls. I wanted to do the work that saved me, right? When I discovered 21st century, it changed me. It gave me a place to put my energy and to sort of displace the feelings I felt about myself so I could feel a sense of worthiness. And I wanted to give that. I wasn't fully developed yet, right? So I wanted to give that to other little Black girls. And in an attempt to do that, I realized there's a root problem here that we're not addressing. Now there's several root problems, right? We can talk about poverty, we can talk about education, right? There are all these root problems that need to be tackled. But this particular one was one that I was deeply familiar with. And I watched other people dismiss it as a social problem, as a social work. You know, this is not, like people do sexual violence in general, right? This is an individual problem. This is not about the community. This is just one-on-one. And it felt like, this is contrary to what you told me. This is what y'all told me. You know? this is what you said. And so that training sort of just kicked in. And it was like, oh, okay, what would happen if that was applied to this?
Right.
Right? What would happen if we were to respond to this, what I'm seeing as an injustice around us? How is it not an injustice for a 12-year-old to lose bodily autonomy?
Right.
How is that not an injustice? Yeah. How do we not, I've also, the other training you have as a young organizer, right, is that we have to be responsive to people's basic needs. And we always define their basic need as food, clothing, and shelter. You gotta make sure people have food, clothing, and shelter. Those are not our basic needs. Those are not our only basic needs. People have to feel whole.
Yes.
What about our interior needs? Those are exterior needs. We have basic interior needs. Our mental, spiritual needs are also important. And so I'm like, I'm looking at these babies, their basic needs are not being met. If we are not walking through life feeling worthy, a sense of self-worth, then that's a basic need. On a very basic level, I should feel like I deserve to exist in this world just because I do. I deserve to be here. I'm worthy of being here because I am here. That's it. Right? That's a basic need. And when you experience sexual violence, other violence too, but when you experience sexual violence, it robs you of that feeling. It takes that sense of self-worth from you. So now our jobs as the people who know that, just like organizers, is to figure out how to give you and meet that basic need. It's like applying principles, right? This is a principle you gave me. It fits here. Let's apply it. Let's see. My thing is, at the very least, let's try. Let's see how this works. Let's try. This has worked for me and other things. It's worked for us. Y'all got, oh, we passed laws, we changed policy, we've moved community, we've done things. I've seen magic happen. Why can't it work here?
Yeah. And it's values, right? It's like core values.
Core values.
How to be in relation to other human beings. I mean, this is, you know, I love when you talk about these babies, because we, in the book, we're with you from when you're a baby through. And even when you're working with the babies, you're still a baby. Right? And for me, I would just say, and my guess is for most people in the world, mm-hmm. there's both an identification with the vulnerability and also with being a silent bystander mm-hmm. so often too. Mm-hmm. And so you walk us through what it means to transform from being someone who just goes along and says, well, that's a social work, to like looking people in the eye. And being honest, you know, in relation, and also honest about, I don't know what to do, but I will see you.
Right.
Acknowledge you.
Right. Because we all like, and it's such a horrible feeling to want to give, want to, we've all had that feeling, particularly with, right? We've all had the feeling of wanting to help a child, to take away their pain, and just not knowing how to do it, right? Not knowing, even in a very basic way, when the baby stubs their toe or hurts themselves, and you're like, I wanna make it better, but you just have to kind of cry through it. But what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna hold you.
Yes, hold
you. Right? I'm gonna rock you, and I'm gonna hold you, and I'm gonna sing to you. Yeah. I'm gonna do all the things I can to soothe you. In those instances, these were children. It's like when you, so part of what my friend, my girlfriend and I just started this work together. And we would go into the schools. We were doing just be our program. And when I would talk to the guidance counselors, I would say, talk to me about the girls you have that are in detention every week, right? Talk to me, tell me who the girls are. I know you have a list somewhere of a bunch of the girls that are close to expulsion. Talk to me about those girls. Because they always want to talk to you about the girls that are on the honor roll. Right. Right, the good kids, right? Oh, I have. Oh, they would love these programs. Oh, these girls will excel. Oh, blah blah blah. I understand. Great. I need the kids. These kids. I need these girls. Let me talk to me about these girls, because these are the girls that nobody has looked in the eyes yes. and said, "You're okay. You're all right. You're lovable too. Yeah. You are. Mm-hmm. Right. These are the kids. The same ones who need the same soothing." Right, the same love, the same healing. Nobody had breathed like the possibility of healing into the lives of these kids. If somebody had said to me at 12, none of this was your fault. Mm. None of it. You're not a bad, just that and walked away. You're not a bad girl, right? You're not a bad person, and you will be okay. You may not be okay right now, but you will be okay by and by, right? That little thing, that nugget in my mind would have been so valuable. And that's really where I started. Cause I was like, that's all I got for you. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And there's, but I mean, but there's, right. So that's where you started, and then you build.
And then you build.
And then there's this moment in your life where, and I, you know, people can look, they know the sort of the unfolding of the event, right? The Me Too event. So I don't want to ask you about that. But what I do want to ask you about is, you know, you're doing very close personal work with girls and women. And then you become part in this stratosphere, right? And it's really one, I mean, I know it's complicated, because it's wonderful, because okay, now we have someone who will really talk honestly, seriously about these issues.
Right.
But there's also, you know, there's way in which it's misconstrued, and you're pulled in all these different directions. You're having to do that correction the same way you do with this teacher, right? And then, so you have this like large public space, and then you decide to write this book, which is like going, so what was that like? Like, what was the sort of balancing between those
you know, folks keep asking me why this book. I remember when I sent the book to Cassie to read it, and his first response back was like, "Why'd you do this?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" He was like, "You didn't have to go here, fam. You could have just wrote like a little celebrity memoir and just." And I'm like, it was hard to write this book,
yeah.
Mostly because this is like, you know, 40 years of story that's been, some of it locked away, some of it, you know, I my ego had led me to believe that I had dealt with some of this stuff that I absolutely not dealt with, and had to deal with it in the writing of it. And then there's like this expectation that I'm gonna tell a story about like going to the Golden Globes and being on the cover of magazines, and that's not, and I might tell that story one day, but it'll certainly be after I have had time to sit with and process what it means and what it ultimately means in the grand scheme of my life and my work, not 4 years later, right? I think it's terribly uninteresting, but I also think it's not as relevant to the work that I've done or the work that I'm trying to do. So I had to really focus on how do I lay out the story of how I got here. Mm-hmm. Not here, like lights, camera, action, but here to the point of having a vision for a movement that I think could impact the world, but impact the lives of people who are carrying this weight in a different way.
Yeah.
Because that's really all it is. There is somebody right now with pen and paper on their living room floor like I was, who was furious, well, maybe not writing, maybe typing, maybe putting notes in their phone, whatever it is. Like, you know, who has a brilliant vision for how we go further than anything that I've ever thought of. It's going to take multiple visions for us to even to put a dent into this thing, because it's just that insidious, is that far reaching, and you know, the breadth and depth of how sexual violence impacts the world requires multiple visions. It requires multiple inventions. This is just a singular one.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to write the story of how we got to this vision.
Yeah.
Why it's important not to divert away into these other things, because I think the vision of it is really important. The origin and the vision is important to understand so that we can keep stay the course, sort of.
Mm-hmm. There are questions, so I'm going to turn to the questions and I just make everybody listen to my questions. But I just related to what you just said. What I love is you use the language, my story of liberation. And that's a very different word than like my story of healing or my story of coming into the, you know, some da, 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 right, that that liberation is really the thing that's indispensable, right? Like being freed of, you know, and then the creation of the world, like what you keep saying, that's collective.
It was very, I mean, clearly it was deliberate, because liberation, I realized, and this is a more recent sort of revelation, excuse me, in my journey, is that it's layered, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't happen all at once. I think sometimes you have an experience that feels liberating.
Yeah.
Like, I'm free. Oh my gosh, I freed myself of that thing. And then when you realize there's still something weighing you down, it feels like some sort of failure that you have. Maybe that other thing wasn't quite it, and that's not really what it is. I am still being liberated. This book liberated me. Like, yeah. This book liberated me even more. But I was that person. I thought, at one point, I'm going to tell the story of how I got free. But I was only free in one sense. You know what I mean? And so, and there was a part of me that got free enough to tell this, to do this work, not just to tell the story. There was a part of me that got free enough to tell, I'm sorry, to tell this story and to be able to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to capture that.
Yeah.
And so that's my liberation. And I think that will help people. Sometimes when you read a story, it helps you feel liberated.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, so one of the questions is, what were you fearful of before writing? And what turned out to be the scariest thing as you got into the writing?
Ooh. Oh, well, before writing, I was fearful that I couldn't do it. Imani is playing professional on this end now, but this book is very much in part because of my good friend, Dr. Imani Perry. I had four people, but two people in particular, and she was one of them. To help me like think through, like she said, I had this writing, but even the blog writing and stuff was sort of just my thoughts. And so I was fearful that I couldn't take those kind of thoughts and blocks of writing I had and make that into something. And it was Imani who took the reading and said, this could absolutely be a book.
Yeah, I was like, you can do it. It's not, I don't know why you're asking that question.
Imani's so nonchalant, like, oh, you're a great writer, please. This is great, you know. So I was definitely fearful that I couldn't do it. And then once I started writing, I said, what was the most frightening thing?
Yeah. The scariest thing is you got into it, yeah.
Well, the scariest thing once I got into it was that I knew that I was going to have to talk about people who were still alive. People who were still, you know, around, people who are still in my life. And have to confront that, right? And they would be, sometimes you don't know how they're going to receive the truth, your truth, your story. And so that was very scary. And, you know, a lot of people walked me through that and were kind of like, this is your story to tell. And if somebody has a different story, they have all the space they in the world to write their own. So I'm standing on that. But that was really scary. And how it would be received, I think, writing it, like.
So it must feel good that it's been received so
beautiful. So far, yeah, it definitely feels good. No, that does.
So there's a set, I want to fold in this question from Deborah Powell, right, where she asked about, yeah, can you talk about how you decided the flow of the book? And I also want to ask about the chapter titles and songs, because the book is a playlist. So both those questions.
Well, the flow of the book was longer. And I think, you know, the editors helped cut that down. But I started the book with No Alibi because I kind of wanted to set the stage for who I am, right? And how I, and sort of my experiences, the stuff I wrote about in No Alibi, you know, about how people talked about me and what I thought about myself was part of what I was building. Like I conflated those things with why I experienced the violence, the sexual violence, right? And so I wanted to kind of just to talk about it. I also think we don't have enough honest conversation about, you know, I've read these articles about like pretty privilege and things like that. And I said this the other day in an interview, like if that's true, then that means then who's the underprivileged, you know? And what's happening in their lives. And so, so I wanted to talk about that because that's just a part of my life. But the titles are, you know, I've always wanted to write. I've always imagined in a book that I wrote that it would be all song titles as a song related. So almost all of them are song or book related, the titles to the chapters. And I don't know. That's just me. I'm so music. I love music. I love hip hop. A lot of them are hip hop and R&B. I think all of them, right? Or hip hop, R&B kind of things. And it would be like what moved me. I listened to a lot of music when I was writing too.
Yeah.
Some of it was like what moved me when I was writing, or I pulled something, you know, out of my, I'm trying to think of one in particular. So like Hypnotized, I called because we were listening to Biggie when, you know, I found that I was pregnant. That, you know, things like that. Or Uptown Baby because I'm from the Bronx and that's, you know, that kind of thing. It's like my little thing.
Well, I love it because also, like, music is such an important part of Black writing because it's sort of like the apex of our artistic tradition. So it made it, and for me, like, it does put you, if you know that those that muse, it puts you in the time and place. And yeah, you feel it as you're, so I thought that was just such a beautiful detail. And also the book titles. I mean, like, so there's this, there's song titles, the book, and then there's Heaven, who is a person, who is just like just a precious.
Yeah, some of them, like Heaven and Me Too, I just had to straight up give it the, you know, that name.
Okay, so now that you're on the other, well, okay. Oh, actually, I was going to ask the big question, but I actually want to ask an intermediate question that is related to the title. And that's the dedication page.
Oh, yeah.
For Melinda, who never knew freedom. For Kaya, so you always have freedom. For Heaven, for helping me find freedom. For Mommy, so that all you feel is freedom.
Yeah. That dedication was really important to me. So, I know, and you know this, but for people who don't know, my pastime, and Imani and I share this sort of this love of genealogy and ancestry. And so I got really, really, really into doing my family's history. And I discovered one of my ancestors named Melinda, who I've just become just enamored with. And in 1863, 1865, am I getting the years wrong? When Emancipation Proclamation happened.
Freedom is the Emancipation Proclamation, 1863.
Okay, 1863. Yeah, she left from the house where she was enslaved, and she went to work as a servant, if you will, in the home of the son of her former enslaver. And she, I think, died there after his, my presumption is that based on my research that she died in his home taking care of his wife who got ill with pneumonia. And so she never knew freedom. And she gave birth to 11 children, 6 of them by her former enslaver. And it just pains me. Her story just gives me so much. I mean, some stuff resonates and just some stuff gives me pain. So I wanted to write for her because, you know, the idea that I have the freedom to liberate myself, not just literally walking around without chains, but just, I think about her life, her material life. Like, did she love? Did she dance? Did she ever have time? You know, because the other men who fathered her children, went on to be pastors and shoemakers and doctors. So they had lives, right? And we know about their ups and downs and all of that, but we don't know anything about her. So I wanted to dedicate the book to her. Of course, my baby, Kaya, who is, you know, everybody who knows me knows is my whole heart. Is young still and young enough to also use this book as a blueprint in other ways that are more intimate than the average reader, obviously, to maybe help navigate away from some of the decisions I made, to connect with some of the things that I did. Like, I just want to make sure that they always have freedom. And Heaven, if you read the book, you'll read about a young child named Heaven who just really changed me deeply. And so I wanted to thank her for helping me find freedom. And then there's my mom, because if you read the book, you see our relationship and how it changes from the beginning to the end. I just want my mother to feel, my mom's 71, and that's a different generation, different, you know, thinking, different whatever, but it really is never too late. It's just never too late to feel freedom. It's something that is so tangible. It's so available to us. And I think particularly Black women of a different age, a different generation, feel sometimes they live through their children or through their, they watch how life changes and think, this is great that y'all have it, but I'm gonna just stay here locked in what I know. And I want my truth, my ability to be truthful, whatever people see as truth telling and courage and liberation in me, I want my mom to feel that. Yeah. No matter what age she is, I want my mother to feel that. I hope she has a whole bunch of time left here, but that the time that she is here with me on this earth, I want it to be free and uninhibited. I want that for all Black women, right? In particular, all Black women. I want my aunt and my aunt is, I don't know if she's watching because I sent her a link, but my aunt is here. My aunt is 60. She looked 40, because,
Right.
But she is so inspiring because she's 60, but she will try new things all the time. Mm. Down to do whatever. Auntie, I'm going to so-and-so. I'm going to go. Come on, let's go. I just love that. And that's a part of feeling free. And so anyway, that's what the dedication is.
The world, there are certain people who don't love and appreciate you, but there are so many more of us who love and appreciate you. I mean, from a distance as well as up close, right? For those of us. But the book is, I think, more than anybody who doesn't know you intimately would have expected or known. And one part of it is that incredible love, right? That multi-generation. There is so much love all the way through, even for those who you might not be expected to have sensitivity or love for. It's just such an incredible gift. I will ask, there's a question that is important, which is thoughts about what media can do to make their coverage more survivor-centered. Maybe I'll also modify that question a little bit, but what all of us can do to be more survivor-centered?
I'm so glad that a person was thoughtful enough to ask that question. It really pains me to watch how the media covers sexual violence sometimes. Although I will say, I think it's gotten better in the last 4 years. I think the language has changed. So I'll say, because I know we have other questions, I'll say succinctly, be very mindful of your language. And I know, it's the news, so you can't be this might be triggering, that might be triggering. I get that. But be mindful of your language. Things like saying survivor instead of victim is a small change, but it's a big thing. The other thing is this focus on the people who caused harm, the person who's being accused. It is really hard to turn on the television and watch this probing into the lives, right? You humanize the person who is either the perpetrator or the accused, whatever, and you dehumanize the person on the other end who said, I've been harmed, right? They become flat all of a sudden. They're just the person who came forward, the accuser, the victim, the person who came forward. That's it. That's all we know about them. And then it becomes this person who worked here, who went to school here, who did this, who's married, who's not married. We know about those lives. So I think some balance in that would be helpful. It's also helpful to understand the breadth of sexual violence and that it is, and when I say the breadth of sexual violence, there's a spectrum that happens and everything from harassment to murder can fall under the spectrum of sexual violence, right? Do some due diligence around that. We have a site called Act2. You can go to metoo.act2.com and read and listen to podcasts. It'll give you books to read, articles to read. Do some due diligence. And one last thing, tell a bigger story. Stop waiting for the next Me Too thing to come forward to talk about sexual violence. It doesn't have to fall under #MeToo to be relevant. Black women have the second highest rate of sexual violence experience in this country. Indigenous women have the highest rate of sexual violence in this country. Talk about what's happening on reservations and in pueblos around this country, how people coming from off the reservation are coming on reservations to rape and murder Indigenous women. talk, when you talk about police violence, talk about how Black women are experiencing not just police harassment, but sexual violence at the hands of law enforcement. There is a bigger story to tell than Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby. So you want to do a better job? Be journalists, be curious. Not just because you're an activist and you want to do the right thing, but there's a bigger story to tell. Be intellectually curious about this as a topic, and you will find a plethora of things to talk about.
And last, I'm going to let the last question go to one of the folks who posted a question, because I think it's such a profound one about seeking words of advice for survivors who have trouble getting past feeling so much shame. So question, transition from shame to what?
This shame to shame resilience, you know, first it is, this is weird feeling. And I was talking to Brene Brown about this, about, you know, you feel shame for feeling shame. So it becomes first, don't feel bad because you feel the shame. Somebody gave that to you. That's part of the intent. We tend to just think about the violence that you experience, the point and moment of violence. That's one part of it. But the experience of sexual violence is the aftermath too. It's what it leaves you with. It's the memories. It's the triggering. It's the shame. And so one part of it, and this is so quick. I hate to give like one step, two step, three step. It's not that easy. And so that's one of the things, is it's not easy. You are not failing because you're not feeling, because you read a listicle and you followed all the advice and you read all the books and you listened to Tarana Burke and you watched the such and such and such, and I still feel this way. It doesn't mean that you're not doing it right. There's no one way to heal. There's no one way to get better. You just have to keep at it. The keeping at it is the journey. Mm-hmm. I think that we have done a bad job sort of explaining that, so people think they're on their way to a destination when you're not. You are doing the work. The shame is going to come. I still feel waves of shame. When I was writing this book, and I would relive it and feel these waves of, why didn't I do this? I wish I would have done that. I've been sexually assaulted more times than I recounted in this book, right? And I had to think to myself, am I not putting this in because I feel shame about it? Or, you know, I had to walk myself through that. So I just want to say, you're okay. You're more okay than you think you are. Let me just say that. You're more okay than you think you are. Being able to sit through this program, being able to type that question and ask, all of those are indications that you're more okay than you think you are. So and it's okay to feel what you're feeling. Allow yourself the space to feel that. There's this weird way that being this Me Too being so big in public makes people feel like they have they have to live up to something. You don't. You're not on a timer. It's not a race. This is your pace. This is your time. Just when you feel like you're not doing it right, I can't get out of bed. I don't know why I'm still depressed. I don't understand why this is still bothering me. That's okay. But remember, you felt worse at some point. Allow yourself to remember when you couldn't get out of bed for 4 days in a row. Now it's been two. Look at you getting out of bed in 2 days. Count it all. Every single thing that you can do that's different than the last time is a step forward. So that when you take a step back, you remember, oh, you know what? I don't live here. This is just a temporary place. It is a lot of work. Don't let people lie to you and put rainbows and fantasies and fairy tales on it. There's an ugly underbelly to healing. But the whole thing is that all of it counts as healing. It won't always feel good. It won't always sit with you well, but it all works. It always is. It's all working for the better. So I'm sorry. That was my 2 second version.
It was perfect. What a blessing. Thank you. I love you so much. And I'm so grateful for you. And everybody who's watching, tell your friends to get unbound.
See you tomorrow.
Bye. See you tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.